The healthcare industry is increasingly embracing the opportunities presented by medical devices, in vitro diagnostics, companion diagnostics, and combination products. The medical devices theme of DIA's 28th annual Euro meeting will examine nanotechnology, medical apps, 3D printing, and other trends in this rapidly evolving field, and also deliver updates on the new European medical device and in vitro diagnostic device regulations. I am Alberto Grignolo, deputy editor of the DIA Global Forum magazine. I'm here in Hamburg at the Euro meeting with John Wilkinson, director of devices for the Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency in the UK, who serves as co-lead for our Euro meeting medical devices theme. We are delighted to have this opportunity to discuss these topics with him. Welcome, and thank you for your time today, Mr. Wilkinson. My first question to you, sir, is discussions about the new EU medical device regulation and in vitro diagnostic regulation comprise a large part of this theme at the Euro meeting. For our listeners who may be unfamiliar, may we ask you to summarize these regulations and their respective states of implementation?
Yes. The history of medical device legislation in Europe is fairly young relative to medicines. About 20 years ago, this first generation of European legislation came into play. So when the European Commission decided to review it, it seemed a sort of timely exercise to do that. That was back in 2008, however. So the process has been one whereby the Commission have placed a consultation document on the table. And normally these political processes and legislative processes in Europe would take 2 or 3 years to run from end to end. This one's been particularly complex, and we're not quite there yet. So part of the reason for that is we had a scandal in relation to breast implants, which intervened along the way and heightened interest. That wasn't entirely a bad thing, in that it raised the profile of medical devices in the minds of politicians, the public, generally, and I think sharpened the debate. But what it did do is slow the whole process down. Most of the things that were on the table for consideration for improving this first generation of legislation didn't change. It just meant that there was greater emphasis and greater scrutiny on them. So I think actually probably in the long run we will think of these rather extended processes as having been useful in some respects to focus public attention on what's going on. So
let me just ask you, was the complexity that you've described driven primarily by the breast implant issue or also by the huge range of medical devices and diagnostics relative to pharmaceuticals, which could be viewed as being somewhat narrow in scope? Yeah. Devices are huge range. Is that adding to the complexity?
You've described the nub of the complexity. I think the PIP breast implant issues really just brought a lot of other people into the debate, if you like, who probably would have not been interested in other circumstances. It would have been a sort of normal revision driven by interested parties, but not a broader set of political and social interests. But you're right, the core of the difficulty with medical technologies is there are in excess of 600,000 products on the market. They iterate, they're engineering products, so they start in one form and 20 years later they look very different and better. So the regulatory decision-making processes are very different from those of pharmaceuticals, which involve a very heavy pre-market load, and then, of course, products stay very stable for a long time afterwards, generally speaking. That's not the case generally for devices. And you've got everything from walking sticks, MRI scanners, implantable heart valves and such like. So it covers a huge range of technologies, and therein lies the challenge and some of the opportunities. And that's why the legislation is risk stratified, unlike medicines. You have, and I know there's a debate in medicines as to whether medicines should be risk stratified. The devices were already there because clearly it would be crazy to apply the same pre-market and market surveillance criteria to a walking stick relative to a heart valve. I mean, it would be absolutely crazy. So I think they're designed to do that. And therein lies a lot of the complexity. And as I say, this second generation of European legislation is really trying to sort of catch up all the bits we've learned applying the first generation and solve some of the areas where there was a feeling that the system wasn't working as well as it might do. So some of it's about management of the system as well as the legislation that's laid on the paper as well.
And what timelines of implementation do you envision at this point?
Well, there's discussions at the moment because the process isn't finished. It's still in debate around the transition periods because The legislation comes into force quite quickly once it's gone through parliamentary process. But the forcing of people to use it is variable. And there have been discussions around 3 and 5 year transition periods, 3 for broader medical device directives and 5 years for the in vitro diagnostics regulation. But therein lies further complexity, because clearly there will be people coming along quite early in the process wanting to have their products certified to the new standards. So the transition period doesn't mean we've got 5 years to get a house in order. It means the thing needs to be completed in 5 years, and you've got to manage the capacity associated with that across the system, as well as ensure that you don't create inequities of access to the regulatory process in that time. So quite a few interesting wrinkles, but I'm sure we'll get there.
Well, so clearly implementation will begin in the early part of the five-year period, if you will. It can start right away.
We're already, although the text isn't finally agreed, we're already drafting our lists of items that need to be attended to. And the way that the legislation is laid out, there's going to be a very large quantity of guidance that needs to be written associated with bits. And indeed, implementing legislation, which is further subsequent bits of legislation, which actually detail precisely how one or other provisions of the directive, the regulation, it was a directive previously, the regulation should be applied. So it's going to be a long and complex process. And there's many in the frame concerned about the sheer volume of activity that's going to be associated with getting this from where it is now to where it needs to be. So
you mentioned guidances, and in your experience, what is the time frame for guidances to be drafted, developed, and finalised? Is it years rather than months?
I think it varies. I mean, I think the reason we're trying to prioritise stuff is there will be some stuff that really needs to be get done rather rapidly, because it's a key piece of a whole load of other things happening off the back of it. So I think some guidance will need to be done quite quickly, and I think the system, if it puts its mind to it, can do that, unless there's a huge degree of controversy around what the shape of that would be. And I don't imagine that will apply to most of the legislation. Most of what's on the paper people agree with. There's some bits, as ever, which people have quite disparate views over, and particularly what the implications of that are for innovation and the pace of getting products through the system, and the costs, of course.
Yeah. Would you be willing to give our listeners a sense of the kinds of guidances that would be prioritised, i.e. finalised earlier rather than later in the five-year cycle? Ooh. Some categories, perhaps, some types, so to give some sense of what you might think is priorities.
I'm not sure I'm qualified to do that, strangely enough. It sounds crazy for me. But I've got teams of people looking at the various aspects of the legislation, and we're sharing our listings with industry and other stakeholders in the system. So I would be very reluctant to sit down and say that's how it's going to work out. Rest assured, I think it's a critical exercise that we do it, so that we really do prioritise the stuff that's important and leave the slightly less important stuff till later on.
Thank you. Let me move to another topic, and that is, much has been spoken and written about increased patient involvement in pharmaceutical research, development, and regulations. That's for pharmaceuticals. Yeah. Are there similar or related initiatives for increased patient involvement in medical device research and development in the European Union?
In terms of the current cycle of activity, we're very focused on the legislation, and it's been painful for many, because there's so much, it's just so much change going on potentially. But there have been a number of discussions around in the margins around how you can improve patient involvement in the whole spectrum of bringing products to market, and I think it's very important. I think the history of regulation has very much been it's technical. It's between regulators and industry and to a degree clinicians, but the patients haven't featured very heavily historically in this exercise. And I think when you're looking at risk, benefits, and how things are going to play out, one, if things go very well or not so well in the system, then I think patient inputs, as we've learned, are extremely important. So there are a number of local initiatives. Certainly my agency has set up a new patient and public forum, which has extended our reach out. I think there are all sorts of very obvious things which you can do very quickly which are around using patients and the public to help you communicate more effectively, which is often a failing of highly technical issues and the people that work with highly technical issues. So I think there's some pretty evident stuff, and that's where we use our forum particularly. But I think there are other bits where it's easy to assume that patients will take a particular perspective on or have a particular tolerance for risk in relation to new technologies. And I think actually when you talk to them, you find that you are quite often surprised. The perceptions of us technocrats, if you like, and industry folk can often be confounded by patients who want to be involved, but want to be ensured that the way that they're involved is in a very transparent and open way. So I think the other piece that actually links back to the regulation is around transparency and the amount of information that gets out to people. The new legislation, interestingly, talks about the need for much greater transparency in terms of clinical evidence for putting products on the market and general performance. So I think that is good in itself, but we've been having conversations with patient groups at European level about what does that mean. You know, we can put a lot of information out there and it could be completely impenetrable to patients. So I think it's a very important issue to get them involved. Nothing particularly concrete and tangible at this stage, but I think it'll become an increasingly important theme for all regulators.
Would it be fair to say that the pharmaceutical side of the house is more engaged with patients than the device side of the house from the regulator's point of view?
I think it would.
Is it fair or unfair to say
that? No, I think it would be. And I think to some extent it's easier because if you look at the differences in the regulatory regime, public authorities run the regulatory process. They do the regulatory process. On the medical devices side, we supervise the regulatory process. Most of the work is done by notified bodies, which are independent organisations. So if you run the process, it's rather easier to say, well, this is where patients should be involved and how you can involve them. We need to have a debate about where it would be sensible and effective for patients to be involved on the devices side, because it's slightly more complex, I think. I might be over-egging that, but I think it is slightly more complex. But the necessity is the same. And I think if you go back, you've got 50 years of pharmaceutical regulation. We've got, it's more than 20 years because there are individual national regimes that predate the European legislation. But, in a systematic, very structured and consistent way, we've had 20 years of pan-European regulation and we've probably got some catching up to do, I would say.
With respect to including or considering the patient voice, and given that medical devices are so very heterogeneous, are there certain categories of device where it would make more sense to involve patient input than for other categories of device? What might those be?
Well, no, I think there are. I think, there's a case to be said for, people who go in to have major surgery and something fitted into their body, kind of in my experience, don't want to know what went on while they want to go in, go to sleep and come out the other end. That's not to say they're not interested in the devices and how they're going to perform, because clearly they are, and that's very important. But the sort of open door, an obvious open door, is where devices are used by patients on a daily basis. And there's lots of those. They tend towards the lower risk categories, but things like wheelchairs, orthotics, some of the diagnostics that are used. So clearly getting patients involved in how do you use these? Are they used? Can you use them? What are the problems with using them? How does that feed back into the next design loop? I mean, it's sort of a no-brainer to do that. It becomes more difficult when you're getting feedback from people who've maybe had a heart valve fitted. Because I'm quite sure how, but I'm sure there are a number. I'm sure that I'm underestimating the level of input you could even get from patients in that context. Maybe not quite specifically in the context of the device itself, but very much in the context of the procedure that was involving the device and how people travel through the healthcare system to get that therapy, if you like, attended to and come out the other end in good shape. So I think there's lots of scope. And again, back in the UK, we've been doing some work with human factors across the agency. It was initiated largely by the devices people to begin with, because clearly human factors are, with tangible engineer, you know, if you're popping a pill in your mouth, human factor is slightly less of an issue than if you're using a very complex piece of instrumentation or something. That said, human factors are a big horizontal issue, and we've set up a number of work streams on human factors. And where patients are using the products themselves, clearly the human factors activity is directed towards them. So I think there's quite a lot of scope in that area in terms of when things work well or go wrong. You know, what's caused the problem? You know, so you can have a perfectly engineered product or a perfectly developed medicine, but if it's used in the wrong way or it's easy to use it the wrong way, then those are issues we need to address as well.
And so there's a clear intent on the part of your office to pursue the patient voice in the future in appropriate ways.
Yes, absolutely.
Mirroring what is happening on the pharmaceutical side of things.
Absolutely.
Right. Another question on a different topic, and that is, more systemic or structured benefit-risk analysis has been a hot topic in pharmaceutical research and development and regulation of pharmaceuticals. Are there similar or related initiatives for more systemic or structured benefit-risk analysis for medical devices in Europe?
There are, and indeed, there's a number of parallel elements. It's given the diversity of products, then, you know, and all of the previous things I've said about the complications of devices relative maybe to medicines come to the fore. But in the end, interventions, whether it's be a medicine or a device intervention, if you like, related intervention, has a risk-benefit equation. Expressing that in a clear and consistent way and having methodologies that help us to evaluate that in a clear and consistent way would clearly be to the benefit of everybody in the system. I sometimes think as regulators, we view the world through the lens of failure because we tend to be very focused on adverse incidents, adverse drug reactions, adverse whatever it is, as a primary data input in terms of our market surveillance activity. And it's easy to potentially miss the other side of the equation, or at least not capture it in an effective and systematic way. So, and I think that constantly challenges all regulators. You know, you say the balance of risk and benefit are appropriate, you know, when we put out public statements, and of course people challenge that. So I think we're beholden to endeavour continuously to develop perhaps more finesse ways of approaching that so that public confidence in those statements is enhanced, I would say.
Talk of a risk-benefit relationship is related in some ways to the value of a product. Once again, if I might make a comparison on the pharmaceutical side of things, much talk exists around the value products, reimbursement, pricing, and the development of products that will be later available for access to patients through an appropriate reimbursement mechanism. On the device side of things, are there interactions between the regulators such as yourself and the HTA community to evaluate the value of devices, possibly to plan appropriate studies of medical devices pre-market for HTA to sort of contribute to the design of programs as sponsors are developing those devices?
Yes, the debate around the relationship between HTA and regulatory processes is not raging, I wouldn't say, in the devices area, but it's certainly very lively. And I personally believe that there's a very significant difference between medicines and devices in terms of the way that the markets operate. There are very few long-term proprietary positions in devices. There's dozens of hip implants on the market, varying propositions. So the sort of competitive dynamics that exists in medicines doesn't tend to exist in devices, and there are very many more probably of each category of product. So I tend to think that the role of medical device regulators, if you like, is to get the maximum number of safe products onto the market unimpeded by any judgments about the cost, because actually the cost is dynamic. And there have been a number of studies that have shown that, like most engineering products, the experience curve applies with medical devices. You know, they start expensive, like flat-screen TVs, and end up not expensive several generations later. And that's a very dynamic situation, whereas with medicines, you do get these fairly long proprietary periods and such like. So I think the dynamics are fundamentally different. That said, there's a lot of interaction between ourselves in the UK and NICE, because we reasonably have an interest and need access to structured data, albeit for different purposes. We have a life cycle interest in the product. We want to know what's the evidence involved with putting it on the market at the start, how that is either confirmed or not in the post-market period, so sort of, I guess, fairly intense post-market surveillance in the early stages, which when you get experience with the products, you maybe lower the bar in terms of post-market surveillance. NICE and other HTA agencies have a different perspective. They're looking at the cost effectiveness of the product over the life cycle. But actually, a lot of that data may well come from the same sources, and it's clearly sensible for manufacturers to structure their data collection as a continuum. So I think, you know, we may historically have seen the sort of pre-market data and then the sort of post-market surveillance. I kind of think of the pre- and post-market divide as being something of an irrelevancy these days. And actually what you're building is data across the life of the product, which serves a number of purposes. HTA is one, safety surveillance is another, and some of that data may be you may be able to structure a collection in exactly the same way and it'll serve both purposes. Some will be very different by definition. So I think, you know, as a planner, if you're planning to put a product on the market, you need to look at the continuum and ideally not waste resources duplicating studies, but build that evidence base for the purposes of both regulatory use and HTA use.
Would you favour, or have you experienced a parallel dialogue among your agency, for instance, the sponsor and HTA bodies to be sort of together in the same room to discuss a development programme and possibly agree on what one would look like?
We're certainly talking with NICE in the UK about how we can support innovation and innovative companies. We have difficulty in generic terms, from a regulatory perspective. HTA, NICE might be able to say you need X, Y, and Z to clear the HTA hurdle, we believe. From our perspective, because of our role supervising notified bodies, we'd be quite reluctant to be very specific about a specific product or situation, because it would potentially bring our supervisory role of the conformity assessment body, which is the notified body, into conflict. That said, we're quite keen to see how we can help companies to work their way through those issues, but we have to separate out. We can't say, here's the advice we would give, that's what will be acceptable for regulatory purposes, because somebody else ultimately is going to judge that. And we're, if you like, measuring their performance, so there'd be a clear conflict of interest. But I think, in principle, we're heading down the same track. You know, how can we make it efficient and effective for companies to bring products to market, get through the various hurdles which are in place to get those products, which clinically and cost-effective, onto the market more quickly? That's, I think, an important part of the regulator's role.
Mr. Wilkinson, thank you very much for your time today, for speaking to DIA Global Forum, and I hope you enjoyed the rest of the Euro meeting. Thank you very much.
Thank you.